back to the show, and I'm your weaver of context for 26 years, Caroline W. Casey. So let us cooperate with everything. We say magic is simply a willingness to cooperate with everything. Pluto is stationing, full moon waxing. It's the full moon, Aries Libra, of dynamic kinship and mutual aid. So this is it. There is nothing more crucial for all of us to animate the all-inclusive invitational story of humans humbly cooperating with our kin. It's before us, you know, to inaugurate the guiding story, you know, democratic animism. Sir Herbert Reed says, only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with technology. So for us all, now and forever, to create the atmosphere that invites the best of everyone to participate, as opposed to mob mind, which invites the worst. And as we know through the years, did you know is one of our essential gifts of spiraling into accord, because no one minds being asked, did you know, unless we ask with a snarky tone, no, I didn't know that. You know, of which our guest and her book are a vast resource. So we host Kristen Olson again, whose most recent invaluable book is Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Stories of Generosity and Cooperation in the Natural World. Yeah, and quoting Darwin's contemporary, the Russian scientist anarchist Peter Kropotkin, a great ally, who are the fittest, those who are continually at war with each other or those who support one another? We at once see that those animals which acquire habits of mutual aid are undoubtedly the fittest. Her website is kristinolson.com. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi.
Well, you're so indefatigable. This is a prodigious and beautiful book. We are offering it as a pledge incentive for a pledge of $150. But just the volume, the beauty, the photographs, the content, the resources, worth it all. And I'll just say, by calling 1-800-439-5732, we'll come back to more of that. But yeah, you're in Reno tomorrow, right? At Patagonia.
I am in Reno tomorrow. I'm giving a talk about the book, and I'm going to be in conversation with my cousin Bob Fulkerson, who's a longtime grassroots activist there. So I'm really thrilled to be talking with him.
No, you're doing it. You're weaving kinship. You're wonderfully indefatigable. It's so great. And reminding us, this book is such a living thing, because as I, from page to page, I'm reminded of allies and allies who've been on this show, because I'm like, oh, beauty and danger and nature. Oh, right, that's the late, great Peter Warshall, wonderful person. You know, Joanne Locke, who wrote Voice of the Infinite and the Small, Healing the Human-Insect Relationship. There we go. Dave Gallo, who said extremophiles at the bottom of the ocean. You know, E.O. Wilson, Tony Hiss. So many great colleagues. But certainly you reminded me of a crucial being, Kropotkin. And maybe we could start with him and then move to Simone Simard and beavers and everything. But shall we begin with Kropotkin?
Sure, we can start with Kropotkin. He was a fabulous scientist, thinker, activist. He was not exactly a contemporary of Darwin. He was younger than Darwin, but he had read... He was a member of a wealthy family, and he was a member of the elite, and he was always somewhat uncomfortable with that. He started getting indoctrinated to radical ideas by some of his tutors, and he was smitten with Darwin's thinking. He read The Origin of Species, and he was just sure that when he got out to do his own research, you know, after he finished his schooling, and he rejected having a cosseted place in the court of the czar. Instead of following up on that privilege, he pushed away from it, and he went off and did 5 years of research, traveled 50,000 miles through Russia, thinking that he was going to follow up on Darwin's work, you know, which was looking at how competition among creatures for precious resources determines, you know, what species survive, you know, the ones who are fierce enough and strong enough to compete are the ones that survive. So he thought he was going to be following up on that research with observations of his own. And instead, what he was struck by over and over again when he looked at what was going on in nature was the camaraderie, the collaboration, the companionship. And he, you know, came away from that those 5 years of research feeling very differently about what it was that shaped and mattered in the natural world.
No, it's so wonderful. And again, I'm dusting off all my Kropotkin and Mutual Aid, which again, he, by his imprisonment, he was catalyzed into clarifying his own thinking. And then just from your book, which I have notes stuck in all the way through, and I just want to say to everybody, this is a great resource, and libraries should have it, and people should teach it, and all people who presume to run for government should read this book about complexity and how we cooperate. And you're quoting him, we know at the present time that all animals, beginning with the ants, going on to the birds, and ending with the highest mammals, are fond of plays, wrestling, running after each other, trying to capture each other, teasing each other, and so on. And while many plays are, so to speak, a school for the proper behavior of the young in mature life, there are others which, apart from their utilitarian purposes, are, together with dancing and singing, mere manifestations of excesses of force, the joy of life, and a desire to communicate in some way or another with individuals of the same or other species. In short, a manifestation of sociability proper, which is a distinctive feature of all animal worlds. I love that. And I should say, in your fabulous book, which has beautiful, Patagonia did a great job, right? You're pleased, right?
They did an amazing job. Oh. You know, when I finished writing the book, and it took a long time to write the book. There was so many people that I talked to, and you know, it was hard, you know, getting all this stuff together. But when I finished the book, and you know, my editors at Patagonia said, "Well, now we're going to start on the art." And I kind of thought, art? I didn't know there was going to be art. But they did such a stunning job with the photograph.
Yes.
Yeah, it's
great.
It's a beautiful object.
It is a beautiful object. It is a work of art. It is in keeping, you know, with let us have only those things in our homes that we know to be useful and believe to be beautiful. William Morris. And it's hefty, hefty. Thank Patagonia and their incredible good works, right? Because the picture is right. Because right opposite the joy of life, just read that in the morning, everyone. Are these wonderful pictures of prairie dogs touching teeth, and you go, So the book itself is an ambassador of kinship. It's like woods, woods, and then you know anarchism, of course. You know Kropotkin, because it's like animals don't need the government. You know, and his escape from prison via red balloons and violins, for fun. You know, Mutual Aid. There, he has a trickster consort, and they distract the guards with red balloons and violins. I wasn't clear.
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay, that's really great. You know, and then the so useful part. That you touch on that is so essential for all of us, the power of metaphor, and really all science is metaphor, you know. And then Kropotkin was particularly dismayed when Thomas Huxley wrote this grim, you know, it's all gladiators and the fittest. but he rejoinders that. You write, Kropotkin had always been leery that Darwin's writings might be misconstrued to encourage an overly harsh view of life. He didn't believe Darwin actually intended that view. In fact, he writes, Darwin intimated that the fittest are not the physically strongest nor the cunningest, but those who learn to combine so as mutually to support each other, strong and weak alike, for the welfare of the community. These communities, which included the greatest number, it goes on and on and on. But that's great. So he takes it on, and Thomas Huxley's rebuttal, going, no, it's all whatever. And then you're also reminding me, he's hanging out with his buddy Emma Goldman, one of the great humans out there, a Cancerian woman, even in the midst of the battle, the Russian Revolution, in which she disapproved of all state agencies, she was still making soup for everybody. and then you say, And then Dawkins later brings in this thing, the selfish gene, and you go off on metaphors matter.
Right.
And I think
you know, that was one of the things that. That was one of the ideas that sort of got me started on this book. I did want to build on some of what really excited me about my previous book, which was The Soil Will Save Us. And, you know, many things about that book were a joy to write about it. You know, it was a joy to talk to these farmers and ranchers and scientists who were trying to figure out how to grow food, harvest food without destroying landscapes. So that was, of course, a great pleasure. But, you know, one of the things that was really earth shaking for me when I finally figured it out that, you know, that plants, and so I was writing a lot in that book about agricultural situations. So plants aren't just takers. You know, there's this line that comes from the purveyors of industrial agricultural tools and chemicals and seeds and all that. You know, their whole thing is based upon saying that plants are just takers, you know, that plants suck up all the goodness out of the soil and leave it devoid of any nutrients. And thus farmers should dump on all these chemicals to make other new plants grow. And so in that book, when I was working on The Soil Will Save Us, and I finally realized that, oh no, that's just not true. Plants are takers, but they're also givers. They are all, you know, they're making that, they're photosynthesizing, they're making this incredible carbon fuel, which they use to grow, but they also share that carbon fuel. They share it strategically with all these microbes that are in the soil, and fungi that are in the soil. And there's a trade that's going on, a partnership that's going on constantly. So every plant that we see is an ecosystem, and we can't see all the members of that ecosystem, but they're, you know, that is a model of mutualism. You know, plants are giving, plants are taking, the soil microbial community is giving and taking. So I wanted to write more about that kind of thing. And then I heard Suzanne Simard, who's this fabulous forest ecologist from British Columbia, and she has been doing 30 years of work showing that that in the forest, trees are sort of constantly in communication with each other, and it's more than communication. They're linked to each other by this vast underground network of fungi, and they are communicating. They're communicating about insect attack or other things, drought maybe. And they're sharing resources, they're sharing carbon, they're sharing other chemicals and nutrients that other trees need. So when I heard Suzanne Simard speak, I thought, yes, I want to write more about mutually beneficial relationships in nature. And then one of the scientists that I reached out to right away, and I was sort of looking for other people in science who are looking at cooperation in nature. And he said, you know, most scientists aren't really looking for that. They're following that paradigm of, you know, that ecosystems are all about competition for resources. And they're looking for competition. They're not even looking for cooperation. So I was really struck, and that's kind of how I got to Kropotkin and, thinking about, how the culture sort of sets the agenda for the science, but then science also, the metaphors and, the kind of science that's done, who funds it, what they're looking for, that kind of sets the metaphors that the culture runs on.
Right. And just in the kind of mytho realm, we say metaphors are the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. Whatever we proffer, you know, gets filled up and animated. So it's a crucial thing. Yeah, so the wonderful work of Suzanne Simard and the Mother Tree Project. And you mentioned, because when I read that, I always bristle about Avatar. You know, it's how Avatar should have ended. And then you mentioned that that actually Cameron got the idea of the mother tree from Suzanne Simard, but then in the last two-fifths of the movie, he does really betray that, right?
Oh, I don't even remember the movie that well, but yeah.
Oh, probably. No, good for you. Well, we want him to come back and listen to Suzanne Simard more. And then, again, as a side, I wonder how Suzanne Simard felt about the character based on her in The Overstory by Richard Powers, because it's like he kind of kidnapped. Did you read that book?
I read that book. I loved that book, and I figured that was Suzanne Simard. I spent time with her in the woods. And
yeah.
I don't remember that coming up. Maybe the book
came out. She's too big to mind. I will mind just for her being smaller. just because, you know, it's a great book, and I told everybody to read it, like, oh, do that. And then again, it's kind of related to everything. The last two-fifths, he kind of trashes it, and he has the Suzanne Simard character, you know, hopeless and, you know, taking herself off stage, which is not at all what's happened. Let's come back to reality here. So she doesn't mind. She's too big for that. But the crucial part that you make is that she once, you know, as a heretic or mutual relationships, it's now like, oh, yes, right? Now she's welcomed like Lynn Margulis and many people you mentioned who are like, no, oh, yes. So this dominance over collaboration everywhere in our life, right, is a crucial one, and collaboration is moving on the move, right?
It is there all the time, and I think there's more and more discussion of it. And yes, and people like Suzanne Simard are shaping the metaphors that and the big ideas that are floating around in the culture now.
Right. And again, I was just reminded of so many great beings. That, I mean, you're part of a whole Renaissance team, really, because we also hosted Ben Goldfarb with his fabulous book, Eager, about beavers. And then you have a whole section on turning what you thought was your enemy into your ally by cooperating, and that, you know, beavers, in fact, fireproof the land. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. His book was a great book. And yeah, that's actually beavers are in two different chapters in this book. I think probably that chapter, I think the one that you're referring to, well, maybe the one that you're referring to is about the ranchers in Nevada learned to work with beavers. Yeah, that is just one of my favorite chapters in the book. And actually one of the daughter of that one scientist who sort of got the work going, she's going to be at the talk that I'm going to give in Reno. So that was a sweet, sweet story of, it's some of the government scientists and government agency people approached ranchers about changing their grazing practices because the creeks, and that part of Nevada is just, it's so dry, it's so desiccated, there are just like threads of water that go through it, and all those threads are highly treasured, and those threads were getting more and more degraded by overgrazing and, you know, climate and all the things that we worry about, and the creeks were getting so shallow and so warm that the local native fish were having a hard time surviving in them. So they approached the ranchers about changing their practices. And, you know, these ranchers are just, you know, they love the land as we do. And their first reaction was, oh, that sounds like a lot of work to change, you know, because it's hard for people to change. It's hard for any of us to change the way we do things. And they'd been doing things like, you know, they'd been ranching like this for generations, where they just sort of turn the cows out at a certain point of the year and then bring them back in at the other end of the year, and they sort of range over the landscape and cause some problems. And the ranchers weren't, they figured that the creeks had always been sort of shallow and dried up in the middle of the summer and weren't great habitat for fish anyway. But anyway, they were convinced to try to change the way they graze the cattle. So They changed things so that they only let the cattle hang around the creeks for a short period of time and then fenced them away for the rest of the time, which was a big hassle, which was, you know, trouble for them. But they did it because they wanted to have good relationships with these scientists and government agency people. Are you going to say something?
I was just going to say, and you mentioned the cows who were like, we're staying here by the creek. No, we're just no, you're not. Oh, all right.
I mean,
right. Anyway, so
place. It's the nicest place there is by the creek. But anyway, so they started to not let the cattle hang out by the creeks all the time, and the cattle, you know, they would destroy vegetation alongside the creeks in a couple of ways. You know, they would eat it down, but also their hooves would sink into the mud and break up the roots and all that. So, you know, miracles started to happen when the cattle were kept away from the creeks for part of the year. So, you know, we have in any piece of land, there are seeds in there that are just waiting for the opportunity to sprout. I mean, some seeds live hundreds of years. So the ranchers, you know, were excited to see, oh, now there's some vegetation coming up along the creek banks. And so more and more vegetation was coming up. And even though it made their job harder because the cattle would get in there and get in the vegetation and would be hard to drag them out of these willow stands. Anyway, you know, it started to move along that way. And then the beaver came, and the beavers started to cut down the willows that were there and started to, you know, pull out some of those grasses that were growing alongside these creeks, and the ranchers were very dubious about that. They have sort of a war, you know, they've typically had a war with the beavers because beavers get in and, you know, mess up their irrigation systems and stuff like that. You know, they were more used to shooting beaver than coexisting with them. But, you know, they stayed back, they let the beaver do their thing, and the beavers just transformed these landscapes. I mean, the before and after pictures in these landscapes is just so dramatic, you know. So the beavers create ponds, and the ponds start to get bigger and bigger, and the vegetation around them spreads. They actually change the water table in the land, and now the creeks that run through they transform what was very much a dry desert into a wetland, and you know, and it's now fabulous habitat for birds and insects and other animals. It creates fodder for the cattle to eat, and it makes the land less prone to fire. It's just an amazing transformation there. And, you know, the other thing that was so exciting for me about that chapter was not only to see how working with the rest of nature, removing the harm, removing the damage that we're doing, how quickly the rest of nature starts to rebuild and create this vibrant life-giving landscape. But the people to do this project, they all figured that they had to cooperate and communicate with each other. So they formed these organizations of ranchers and scientists and folks from the government agencies, and they would meet, you know, they would, it was a very prescribed way that they met. They were determined to have consensus and cooperation and collaboration. So they would meet in these rooms where they would circle the table so that nobody was at the head of the table, and everybody had a voice. Everybody was going to be respected. And they had a social worker there helping if at times things got hot. And, you know, there was somebody who was going to get angry or somebody who was going to have their feelings hurt, to help them get through that. So, you know, there were two really marvelous transformations there. You know, one was the transformation of the land, but the other was the transformation in the relationships among these people who do not always get along.
That's perfect. Right, because over and over again, you talk and about coalition building, again, the political, the spiritual, the biological. Let's take our models from nature. That's so great. And I'm so glad you just brought up the round table, right, comprised of equal individuals contributing, right? So it's You know, the story is told that King Arthur in the Round Table, which was an experiment to have, you know, informed, you know, spiritually cultivated people engaged in governance. But then at the end of the Arthurian legends, all the hip people go away for a while, right? But the myth was to await the world's call at a time of danger. And we go, now would be really good. Come back for the Round Table consensus and coalition building that's so wonderful. And then you mentioned that while you're writing this, because you're attracting, you know, all your kin, you're forming the web, right? That somebody gives you Kelly Clancy's essay, Survival of the Friendliest, which is super charming, right?
It was super charming, and it introduced me to a lot of ideas that I hadn't come across before. You know, the idea that I loved and embraced in that was this concept of relaxed selection.
Yes, I underlined that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, you know, it's not that an organism, plant or animal or fungal, an organism can survive and thrive, not necessarily because they're the fittest or the strongest, but there might be some outside force that intervenes to make living easier for them. So like an abundance of something that they like to eat shows up, or, you know, something acts upon their circumstances to make it easier for them to thrive, or another organism makes it easier for them to thrive. And, you know, I think the most valuable things that Kelly Clancy pointed out in that is that creatures themselves relax selection by the things that they do. So beavers are relaxing selection pressure on themselves by building dams and creating ponds, because they're making they're irrigating a landscape that grows the things that they like to eat. They're creating a safer place for themselves. So that's one way that beavers are relaxing selection on themselves. We as humans, you know, we relax selection on ourselves in a million ways. You know, we relax selection by wearing bike helmets and by having traffic signals and by having healers and, you know, if you think of all the things that we do to make our lives, you know, stronger and more successful. And I love that idea of relaxed selection, thinking about how I think that's what's called upon in this time now, that we humans start to relax selection on the rest of nature. You know, we over and over again, we do things that make it so hard for other species to thrive and for ecosystems to thrive. But when we pull back the damage, when we stop doing the damage, so when we relax that selection pressure on the rest of nature, you know, we can see that nature bounces back so amazingly.
Right. And you know, from the first chapter all the way through, you know, again, what we know, but you put it in such guiding clarity, you know, it's the humans' ill-informed galumphiness going roads, things on top of these networks of complexity and civilizations, right? Yeah, so right, and relax selection, like with the beavers, it's like then you take the pressure off and then they can have beaver culture in their incredible architecture where they probably, you know, devise stories all night. Right. So that's really wonderful. Well, let me just do a little pitching here because we're being too fascinating, but don't go away. So team, we are coalition building here. This is mutual aid. This is our wonderful guest, Kristin Olson, and her just such a rich resource, beautiful book, photos, but each page, really, I have sticky notes all the way through, sweet in tooth and claw. And for us to be effective citizens now, really, is to be informed, you know, of this realm and be reminded of, you know, all our great allies. You know, there are so many people working on, indeed, ingenious collaborative ways. So this book is available as a thank you gift to you, For $150, it's worth that. It really is. By calling 1-800-439-5732 or pledging online kpfa.org. We're also offering Visionary Activist Show archives, but I'll delineate that further. Right now, we have the luxury of our guest, Kristen Olson. So allow me to keep her here by calling. That would be really good. 800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org. So for Relaxed Selection, for coalition building, for Kropotkin's work, for mutual aid, for the crucialness of now, politically, spiritually, everything, the earth is on the ballot, right? I mean, it's like a cartoon grotesquerie. It's life and ingenuity or evil, rapacious greed and death. It's pretty much that way. And it's like, all right, we're voting for reality with everything, and voting for reality by pledging to this station and its dedication to the Visionary Activist Show that will continue to bring Kristen Olson and late wonderful allies Peter Warshall and Joanne Locke and Dave Gallo and E.O. Wilson and much on viruses. I want to come back to viruses as well. But so I'm watching you. I can see you moving to the phone to call. That would be so wonderful to allow us to continue to cahoot with Kristen. And you can keep cahooting with Kristen with this really valuable book, Sweet and Tooth and Claw, published by Patagonia. So it's just great all the way through, in every fiber of its being, and every beautiful photograph that is generous, right? Right, because Patagonia, when you said about art, here's the male Vogel cop. You can open this book like a divination tool, really. The bird of paradise calls from his display log. Every photo is like, oh, that's so wonderful. So this is a treasure of a book. And again, Patagonia is kind enough to be proffering it to KPFA so that we can, you know, all form coalitions of effectiveness at this crucial time. So for this book, again, the wonderful book, Sweet and Tooth and Claw by Kristen Olson. Invaluable. Just reading a chapter a day, really wonderful. And informing people of what you find out. Many people listening, dedicated listeners for 26 years, know much of the material, but I guarantee you don't know all of it. We want to always be learning, always learning. That's, you know, part of our positive humanness. You know, again, for our rogue species to have manners. So again, 1-800-439-5732. All right, we've done what we could for a moment. Kristen, let's go to hurricanes for fun. Because that takes us, you say, sucking up particles and expelling living microbes. So we go to that realm, and that's an increasing, you know, phenomenon.
Right.
Anything you want to say about?
Well, that came up in the chapter where I talk about the microbial world. I mean, so I started that chapter with an anecdote about Amelia Earhart, that she, you know, I'm just sort of interested in how long people have been sort of trying to figure out the microbial world. But Amelia Earhart, on one of her flights, she had this tube that she had on the outside of the plane where she was, when she was up in the air, she would reach out and try to collect microbes on this, on a slide for scientists. But yeah, so the scientists who are doing that now are going up much farther than she did and kind of cataloging what's living way out there. There are basically microorganisms, basically bacteria and viruses and other things that are even smaller than that. Those things are living kind of everywhere scientists look. So they're way out in the atmosphere. They're in boiling vents. They're everywhere. And I think that the microbial world is kind of like the connective tissue that binds us all together. We can't get away from it. You know, I think that before the pandemic, I always used to get so annoyed when I would go to a grocery store and they would have the hand sanitizer to use. And I would think, just so ridiculous to be trying to kill everything off. And of course, the fear about the coronavirus reignited that kind of, I think, intense reaction to the invisible world. And it's understandable, of course, but we really cannot get back to that, that fear of germs, because they're in us, they're on us. They, we have viruses that are resident in our mouth.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Exactly. And I was actually open to the slightly different quote too, because I love your jaunty narrative throughout this deep, deep, deep material. It's like Wendell Berry says, be jaunty, even though fully informed, right? And so on the other side of the kill everything, you go, now probiotics are all the rage, right? Probiotic chocolate bars, probiotic whatever the thing is, whatever. And you say, but despite what might be massive and dismaying overhype by manufacturers, it's an amazing time to be alive and to reconceive our connection to the rest of life on this planet. It's like, go, Kristen, that's adorable. and then that takes us to viruses. Yes, we want to honor them, as you say, much maligned. And you have a great many great sections. Wait, I have some of them here. But I'm also, we want to know a great deal. I'm reading a great book on viruses, Spillover, by Daniel Kahneman, and it's again what we know. He says, a revered and respected scientist says, ecological disturbance causes diseases to emerge. Right, got
right.
that. Right. It's like, when will the pandemic be over? It's like, well, when we quit despoiling the earth, And so you have great things to write. Can I read the puckish take on that you have here? Let's see. New Mexico State University molecular biologist David Johnson, just for fun. Can I read that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so it's in this wonderful book. It's in there's so much here. He says, Kristen, quoting, I see plants as microbes' first experiment with artificial intelligence. They needed something else to capture energy for them, so they helped develop the plant. Then they realized plants weren't mobile enough to get them all the food they wanted, so they developed versions 2.1 animals. And somewhere along the line, they went horribly awry and came up with humans. Anyway, it's charming and probably true. Right, and then let me thank you, Nadine and Martinez, California, who pledged for this beautiful, beautiful book. Thank you, CC. Thank you yourself. And Jen in San Bruno says, Trees by Joyce Kilmer, very important in my life. I wrote a little poem when I was in third grade about trees. They hold you in their strong arms. And even I thought it was a little sentimental and cheesy, but it was a big hit. And somebody gave me a book with Joyce Kilmer. I think that I will never see a poem as lovely as a
right.
tree.
Right, I remember
and it
that.
It was, yeah, crucial. And somebody gave me a, Hummel figure. Anyway, it was a landmark thing, trees. We form these bonds. So let me continue to exhort here in our exhortational moments. You can have this wonderful book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, and as a thank you gift for a pledge of $150. Nadine did that. There we go. By calling 1-800-439-5732. And then the virus part. Well, again, I'm searching through my fingered virus is getting a bad rap, right? But yeah, it's feel free to run in while I here's just a super great thing about complexity, and for humans to cultivate complexity before doing anything. And you also write, and here I quote you, Rosnick became fascinated with viral symbiosis. I love that. Viral symbiosis, when she and colleagues conducted a study in Yellowstone National Park, they found that some plants could tolerate the extreme heat near geysers and hot vents, but only if the plants had a symbiotic mutualism, I just want to repeat that too, symbiotic mutualism, with a certain fungus that was infected by a certain virus. It was a beautiful three-way symbiosis. I think they're very common, but it's hard to study them, right? So wonderful intricacy, right? The plant with the fungus, but only if the fungus has been infected by a certain virus. And it's like, yeah, cooperate with everything.
Right, and that's what allowed those plants to live by hot vents and geysers in Yellowstone Park. It gave them a superpower. I know, it's just so amazing. And it really made me think about, I mean, how much could science possibly know? I mean, I accompanied Suzanne Samar to do research deep in the forest for the Mother Tree Project. And it is a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. It takes a lot of funding. I think it's impossible for science, you know, all of these mutualisms are, it takes a lot of science to tease them out. I mean, how can they even find everything? I think we just have to assume that there is this incredibly complex dance and collegiality going on around us at all times, even if science hasn't been able to, you know, peel back the lid and figure it out, because it's just so complex, and it takes so much work to find. But it's amazing. It's amazing what we're surrounded by.
Right. Well, that's why we're grateful to you, to Suzanne Simard, to all the people you referenced, to your beautiful book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Stories of Generosity and Cooperation in the Natural World. Kropotkin is backing you up. Go, girl, says Kropotkin. So, which is crucial. And then I am going to reluctantly release you in about 4 minutes when our pledge captain will join me in exhorting. But before we go, you know, it's so... This is a book that's useful always, all the time. But really, as you say and know, and so grateful that you brought it out now, so crucial for everyone now. And then just even what we eat, when we consume more complex carbohydrates, we're actually taking care of all these different food chain levels, and that creates a more diverse and resilient ecological system inside our body. And then you say, when we eat sugary junk food, sugar-eating microbes proliferate too, but their abundance doesn't confer the same benefit. So, you know, for you, may this book spiral forth, may your dedication be increasingly influential with all of the kin who are doing related work. But I've been, you know, tracking you in Facebook and whatnot too. And do you have a wish for Biden's farm bill and regenerative agriculture? If you could wave a wand, what would it be?
Oh boy, it's not a simple wand. You know, the Kiss the Ground people down in L.A. have a big campaign called, I believe, Regenerate America, they're really trying to summon politicians and summon popular support for really paying attention to the farm bill, because that determines how our tax dollars are spent on agriculture. So do we want the agriculture that's destroying landscapes, or do we want the agriculture that actually gives habitat to birds and insects, that builds soil health? It's such a hugely important thing, and it's something that, you know, I think ordinary people think, well, that's for policy wonks to figure out, but all of us need to get on that train and push for agriculture that favors ecosystems.
Right. And that's why, the accumulated coalition building, like, you know, you and then reporting on the ranchers and how they came to collaboration with the beavers and stuff. And as you say, and as Ben Goldfarb does in Eager, you know, there's resistance, like, well, identity even intertwined, like, it's hard to change. And we just go, harder not to, because, as you say, there's nothing that moves our profound kinship DNA more than before and after photos going, ooh. So it's like, again, it feeds the soul of those ranchers and farmers, right? Aren't they delighted by the beauty?
Oh, they are delighted. And I forgot to say, when I was talking about that before, you know, remember they said that these creeks have always dried up in the summertime, as far back as anybody can remember. Those creeks stay wet. Those creeks have running water all summer now. And that's just amazing. Who would think that would happen by changing the way cattle are grazing, and that the beaver could do that? But, you know, we can have such profound changes on landscapes that we think are permanently damaged, but there's always the potential of life there when we remove the damage, when we remove the things that we're doing that interfere with the joy of life.
Right. Right, and then you end with the paintbrush. Do you want to do a little homage to the paintbrush plant on your way out?
You know, the paintbrush plant, I'm up in the Sierra Nevadas right now, and the paintbrush plant, which is an awfully pretty thing, has been, you know, somewhat maligned recently when scientists discovered that they were, that their roots penetrate the roots of other plants, nearby plants, and they suck out some nutrients and all that. But it turns out that it's, of course, a lot more complicated than that, that the paintbrush plays a role in not letting one plant dominate, that it's, you know, that there's what they call the dryad effect, named after female spirits from Greek mythology who live in trees and create sacred groves as they nurture their own trees as well as the living things around them. So the paintbrushes concentrate nutrients. And it's a boost to the little ecosystem there. It boosts plant diversity in an area. It attracts more birds and insects. It increases pollination. So even this beautiful plant that people had started to give the stink eye to, it's building ecosystems.
Right. No, that's wonderful. Well, Kristen Olson, thank you so much. I'm grateful forever. I hope we can continue conversing in some form. I will certainly continue touting this really generous act of mutual aid as the contribution of your book. Thank you so much, Kristen.
Oh, great to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, I think I'm being joined by our fierce and fabulous Aries fund drive captain, possibly. But let me thank some people. Yay. So Laura in Los Angeles contributed $150 for Sweet and Tooth and Claw by Kristen Olson. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much. But now here we are. Because all the themes we're talking about, you know, coalition building, mutual aid, this is it, to and fro, you know, cross-irrigating, you know, and so, you know, this station pours much out, you know, but really, you know, it's a confluence, it's a weaving. The show, the Visionary Activist Show, I know it continues past its airtime because people organize and connect and get together and talk about the books and talk about the things. The airwaves are alive, and radio is so democratic intrinsically. TV is kind of like, you know, slimy. But radio and listener-sponsored radio is a rare and increasingly crucial, useful thing. So I you know, do exhort. And reading Kristen's fabulous book, El Maria in Berkeley, thank you so much. Because reminded of, like, oh my goodness, I've hosted a lot of these people, you know, Eager by Ben Goldfarb and Peter Warshall. Again, the ancestors, the guests in the past who are now ancestors, but wonderful, wonderful humans that we honor. You know, Peter Warshall, you know, Beauty and Danger, and Paul Stamets, Innumerable Times, and Regenerative Agriculture, and Yes, Kiss the Earth. We did that. Stephen Buhner talking about the intelligence of plants, and, you know, and Dave Gallo and E.O. Wilson and Tony Hiss. And just, it goes on and on. Really, pretty much, a huge part of the dedication of this show is summed up in the, you know, cultivated, profound erudition of Kristen Olson and this book. And as she mentions, it's a lot of work hanging out with Suzanne Simord in the forest and tracking these things. You know, and when you read Spillover about viruses, the detectives going, how does this work? And how do we explore complexity in order to be better humans with manners? Well, manners of reciprocal blessing. So we are really calling for reciprocal blessing to and fro, you know, by calling 1-800-439-5732. And let me further entice people. Can I hear you breathing, Laura?
Yes, yes, you can. I'm a heavy breather.
That's great.
Yeah, so, beautiful, beautiful book that you chose to have on today. I loved her, and I loved. There goes my cell phone.
No, that's good. That's somebody calling in. That's spirits calling in. That's where they were exhorting that.
But yes, yeah, I mean, all the words that she was using about nature, I thought really applied to what we do here at KPFA.
Exactly.
Collaboration, companionship, partnership,
coalition building,
mutually beneficial relationships. I mean, that's exactly what we're asking for right now. It's for the mutual beneficial relationship to kick in and for people to support the programming that we have all the time, this beautiful programming like today, and the opportunity to get this book at the same time as supporting this radio station and our cause and our all of our expenses that go into. There's a lot of work to put this radio station on the air every day. So we do need your support. And you can get the book by Kirsten Olson today for $150 pledge to KPFA. You can go to kpfa.org. That's the easy way to donate. And you can also call 1-800-439-5732.
Yeah, no, it's really crucial. So coalition building, and let us say what we all know. This is a really important time all around now. You know, the election is crucial. Everything, you know, life is on the ballot. So everything we do now is a kind of voting, right? And that includes, you know, voting for these voices and voting for the community that comes out of KPFA and the Visionary Activist Show. So that, because really what is it to be a good citizen? Whoops, I noticed my sound has wavered. Let me fix myself here. Well, no, it's a mystery.
Yeah, you sound a little quieter than you were before.
I do.
Now it's changing.
No, don't do that. Well, we'll try that. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, that's better. Yes.
Yes, the cats often fiddle with the dials. All right, so live radio. So pledge on behalf of your cat. I hear many cats and dogs listen to this show, so pledge for those who don't have the fingers to dial or to get on the computer. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. And let me entice you. We're also offering, and people went for this last week. It was pretty good. Visionary Activist Show Archives. Yeah, we've been rummaging. I'm particularly fond of rediscovering Pir Zia, a show I did with him in December of 2009, and it's like really powerfully great. He said it was one of the favorite things he ever did. And that's also with Lily Ye. All people, again, Janine Benyus, Naomi Shihab Nye, Alex Gray, you know, all people who are, again, we're in this together. So everything that everyone does, you know, matters enormously. And also, what is it to be a good citizen? What is it to be a good citizen of a democracy and a good citizen of the planet? And, you know, well-informed and also reciprocal blessing. May it go well for you, right? Magnetizing to and fro. So for a pledge of $100, you can have this downloadable, because who needs plastic CDs, collection selected by my artist of order, Aaron Alloway, and myself. All pretty great. You know, and rummaging around in the ancient past, you know, Alex Gray from 2003, these are all timeless. Naomi Shihab Nye, kindness, always great. Janine Benyus, I reference that interview from 2008 all the time. It's incredibly useful. Very briefly, I asked her then, what is vertical integrated hierarchy, this biological term? She said, oh, it's this beautiful thing. It means everything in nature contains the plan of the larger thing it's a part of. This is what makes for nature's resilience, ingenuity, and self-assembling. So she was very kind at allowing me to tease that into our strategy and our strategy now. So as we dedicate, also known as pledging, right, it increases our external, you know, signal. So we're more likely to be danced into place with the larger thing that we're a part of. This is a confluencing of allies kind of time. And thank you, Janet, in Kailua, Hawaii. Yay! And thank you, Patricia, in Bay Point, California. Yay! All right, team, we're getting there. This is a crucial time. And to wonderful, wonderful ally Laura Privis, I say, in the spirit of, you know, Rachel Maddow and Amy Goodman, Laura Privis is a fellow Woofie Aries, whose Venus at 25 Aries is conjoined KPFA's Sun at 25 Aries, and its image is a woman bursting with gifts more than she can hold. That's Laura Privis, and that's this station, bursting with gifts more than they can hold, right? And we want to cultivate, you know, again, to and fro, that this be a mystery school, a citizen training, a, you know, informed realm for everyone to go out to be ever more effective, that crucial thing. Kailua Hawaii says, "Mahalo nui for all you do to keep us informed. I'm very grateful for Letters in Politics and for Caroline Casey and the talkies." Me too. What a great team. You know, Mitch Jezerich is a fabulous colleague, and so is Chris, absolutely. Oh, Rose and Sonoma pledged for the book. Thank you. This is wonderful. We're getting into the almost respectable realms.
And we really need it right now. I mean, we are very far behind in this fall fund drive, and, you know, this is the time that we need people to step up. We don't want to have to extend the drive.
That's
diminishing returns. We don't want to do that.
So if you can,
if you have the means, this is the time that we really need your help. And we'd love to see you support this program and all the programs that are on this station, you know, like... all in this together.
Did Behind the News really raise $26,000 in their hour?
You know, there is a very super large donation in that hour that we're still trying to, like, double confirm that person actually put that many zeros behind their donation. But possibly.
We invite you, you know, your liberating trickster and all of our super dedicated listeners, you know, some just jumping in recently, some have been here for 26 years, to contribute in a spirit of whimsy. Really, any donation is a priming of the pump. You know, it could be small or surprisingly large. That would be super witty. Recurring. Right. Yes. $15 a month gets you something wonderful. Oh, the book, or The Myth of Normal, if you want to focus on trauma, which is okay. That's right. And then, and Patricia in Bay Point says, wouldn't want to live in a world without KPFA. No, and you don't have to. We're here to say that, you know, again, rousing and, again, wonderful, Laura, here to co-pitch a great constellator of community. This is a community. And so exhorting, this really is a great book. I know on shows sometimes, we go, you win some, you lose some. But this really is a wonderful book, sweet in tooth and claw. And what it represents and our conversation, which was just like a little microdose of this, not to mention the entheogens that we also focus on as part of this whole collaboration, guiding humans back to good manners. So if you're pledging for humans to have good manners, really, that's the thing. Anybody who would like humans to have good manners, just pledge anything.
Right. And the number is important. 1-800-439-5732. Yes. And KPFA.org. There is someone on the line. Please join that person if you can, or at the KPFA.org website. It's really easy. You can pick out the book. It's up there right on the first page that you go to, so that makes it easy for a $150 pledge. 1-800-439-5732.
Michelle in San Francisco, thank you. You have pushed us into respectability almost with her generous pledge. Thanks, Caroline. You're great. And you are too. It's to and fro. So, and Laura, you're such a good exhorter. Just feel free to exhort.
Yeah, well, we only have a minute left here, but yes. We do need to ask for your help right now. Please support KPFA. Please support all the collaboration and partnership and knowledge that comes through this radio station for you and for your community. KPFA.org is the best, easiest place to do it, or 1-800-439-5732. And we thank everyone who has donated so far in the drive and in this hour.
Especially. And who's thinking about it even now, 1-800-439-5732. And for the whole team, Laura's a crucial part of the team, our campaign leader, and Board Ops, Kirsten Thomas, best in the world. It's a whole team that we are confluencing of allies with a dedicated theme now. Okay, we will reconvene. Thank you, Laura.
Yes, thank you, Joanna. in Montecito.
Oh, excellent. Yes, thank you.